Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is a pioneering scientist in the field of space archaeology, the use of satellite imagery to identify unknown archaeological sites around the world. Over the past decade, archaeologist and Egyptologist Sarah Parkak and her colleagues have identified heretofore unidentified sites and well-researched sites like Tanis in the Egyptian Nile Delta, the ruins of a Roman amphitheater in the port city of Portus in Italy, and a huge ceremonial platform at Petra in Jordan. She's also found more unknown sites like Celtic and Viking sites in the British Isles and an ancient Dacian capital in Romania. She's also documented areas where looters are active, helping authorities protect some of these heritage areas around the world. As a winner of the $1 million TED Prize for her idea to employ remote sensing imagery and crowdsourcing to discover and protect unknown heritage sites, she's used the prize to create Global Explorer, a platform that has used thousands of online amateurs to map the entire nation of Peru. They begin work on India later this year. Parkak is a professor of archaeology at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and she'll be the next Tulsa Town Hall speaker next week, and the second speaker in their new series, After Dark, Thursday evening, April 11th at 7 o'clock. This program is designed for those who are unable to attend the traditional Friday morning lectures. Sarah Parkak is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Sarah Parkak, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You've been in the forefront of using satellite imagery to find archaeological sites around the world. And I know we've been using Landsat imagery and satellite imagery for all sorts of uses here on Earth. But when did archaeologists start using this tool to identify undiscovered sites?
So the history of the field actually goes back over 100 years. Archaeologists were some of the first people to use aerial photographs period for looking at sites and features. And a lot of people don't know this, but in World War I, some of the volunteers that were serving in the Royal Air Force for the UK were amateur photographers and archaeologists as well. And they would fly over sites in places like the Middle East and take pictures for fun. And when the commanding officers saw these photos, they said, wait a minute, you can take pictures from an airplane to see things. And to us today, that sounds like, well, of course, but back then, this is a really amazing new technology. So it's actually archaeologists that helped to inspire the use of photographs for spy reconnaissance. So it's kind of come full circle now. I mean, really, in terms of satellite, you know, the field has been around since the early 70s when NASA first started the Landsat program. But I would say, if you'll excuse the pun, it's really taken off in the last 15 to 20 years. And it's gotten to the point now where it's pretty standard for archaeologists to use this technology.
Really? Okay. So is it a dedicated use of a satellite, or is it basically using existing imagery and using different information or putting different algorithms to use to help find archaeological sites?
Oh, having our own satellite would just be a dream, but I don't have a spare $250 million kicking around in my couch change, so I'll have to keep looking. But what we do is we use standard satellite data sets. So with NASA imagery, you know, all that data is free and available for use by the public. So there are millions and millions of satellite images that we can use, but that's more for large-scale landscape analyses. Most of the data we use is commercial satellite data. And most of what I use is from a company called Digital Globe. They're in California, and they're Maxar Technologies. They're the largest commercial satellite technology company in the world, and I think they've got 7 or 8 very high-resolution satellites now, and there are millions of images in their databases for the globe. So if any of us want satellite imagery, we just look through the database and order the imagery. But it's not actually that, it's not that expensive. Most of the time, you can get a pretty good high-resolution satellite image, so under a foot, for a few hundred dollars.
And so they're taking images of the Earth at all times, and you just basically are looking for a nice clear day to be able to look at an imagery. And then I assume you're putting filters in place to look at that image in a different way than just a virtual satellite image.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, for example, if I'm mapping or my colleagues are mapping looting at a site, we're primarily interested in looking at progression over time. So the time of year generally doesn't matter, especially if you're in a, you know, large part of South America or the Middle East. you know, you don't want imagery on a cloudy day, but for the most part, you're okay. But in many, many parts of the world, a time of year is really important. You know, think about what we just saw in the UK last summer with its incredibly 2 or 3 months without rain, so a drought. And because of that really, really dry weather, we saw what are called crop marks. So these indications with either presence or absence of vegetation of things that are buried beneath the ground, you know, old churches, Roman villas, Iron Age hill forts, etc. So we look for images at particular times of year where the vegetation or groundwater moisture are optimal for analysis. We order the imagery, download it, and then we process them using standard off-the-shelf remote sensing software. It's the same stuff that's used by biologists or meteorologists or urban planners. And then we process the data to look for very subtle differences that may indicate things that could be under the ground.
So how does the drought affect your being able to see under the ground? Is it a matter of if, say, there's, I'm just going to throw out in the desert southwest, an adobe structure, it might actually be a little more moist than the ground around it?
Right. So it depends on, of course, the ground cover and the features that are there. In places like the UK or Europe, you've got mixed environments, but you have a lot of field systems. And if you have, say, a buried Roman villa, which is made out of stone foundations, the roots of the vegetation on top of that are not going to go as deep because it's stone. And so the vegetation is going to have its growth stunted. So even if it's really wet, you know, that vegetation isn't going to be as healthy. But if it's really, really dry, that's going to pop out to a far greater extent. In desert areas, as you say, if it rains or if there's additional moisture, then if it's an adobe or some kind of mud brick material, that's going to absorb the moisture, and then you're going to be able to see really clearly what's there. Now, when we're talking about that, most of the satellite imagery that my colleagues and I use is called optical satellite imagery. So this isn't radar. So we're not actually seeing under the ground. We're seeing very subtle hints on the surface that indicate what's under the ground.
I see. So you're actually looking at the vegetation on top of the soil and looking for differences a lot of times.
Yes.
Interesting. So how scientific is this approach? Is it work all the time? Does it work most of the time? Sometimes if you think you see a wall, does it turn out to be just something natural?
It being science, I mean, we fail frequently, far more than we ever succeed. I teach an introductory satellite remote sensing course at my university, and then I follow that up with an advanced course. And after a full year of intensive coursework, students are ready to begin their project work. So it's not easy. You can't pick it up, at least that really, really technical part of what we do. There's a real science to it. So you have to learn the physics aspects, so how essentially the physics of light. You have to learn algorithms and processing and how individual pixels can be analyzed depending on what's on the surface of the earth, whether it's vegetation or soil or something else. So, yeah, it's a matter of trial and error because in some cases you can guess at the techniques that might work, and in other cases you can throw the kitchen sink at a site, and it may be that you have data from the wrong time of year. It may be that there's been too much rain or too little rain. You really have to have a good understanding of the landscape and the weather patterns in addition to the science of the remote sensing. So, yeah, oftentimes we'll try and we won't find anything, or it could be that, you know, we think we see a clear wall or structure feature, and then we get there and it turns out it's modern. So then we just go back to the drawing board and try again.
You were talking about how you teach the class to your students at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. I think that's sort of how you got into it when you were at Yale. I think they weren't really teaching archaeology as through remote sensing, but they were teaching a satellite class. And that's how you first started saying, hey, I think this may work in my own work.
That's right. Yeah, I took the course my senior year there, and I was in the class with forestry environmental sciences grad students, with students from the biology department, School of Public Health. There were some anthropology majors. It was really a mix. And that tends to be the breakdown that I get in my classes of students from all over UAB's campus. It was a pretty intense course. I definitely did not have a strong enough science background when I started, but I'm obviously very, very grateful I took the class.
And I guess most of the students at the time that you started thinking about this, using this in archaeology, most of the people were using it for typical land use, like city planners, environmental scientists, people looking at pollution rates or public health rates or things like that. They weren't thinking of, let's find an ancient Egyptian city.
Right. I'm trying to remember. There are a lot of students in my class, and it was every year it gets hazier and hazier in terms of what I'm able to remember. I don't know that there were other archaeologists in the class. I know a lot of archaeologists obviously have taken that course since at Yale. But mostly it was people like urban planners and looking at, growth rates in cities over time, or climate change scientists, so grad students or postdocs that were interested in, looking at how climate change is affecting polar ice caps. Yeah, I think I was the only one. And, I took the course thinking that, a number of archaeologists had done this work, that I would just be kind of getting in line. I did not know that hardly any Egyptologists or people specializing in the archaeology of Egypt had used this technology before. So I got very lucky in terms of when I took it. So I was definitely an earlier adopter of the technology.
Yeah. My guest today is Sarah Parkak. She's an archaeologist, Egyptologist, and space archaeologist. She's a professor of archaeology at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and she'll be the next Tulsa Town Hall After Dark speaker, speaking Thursday evening, April 11th at 7 o'clock, and tickets are available for the event. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Let's talk about some of the things that you've found. I know anybody who knows the film Raiders of the Lost Ark know the city of Tanis. You've actually done work on Tanis, right?
I have. I like so many children of the 1980s, it was one of the movies that we rented when I was a small child. And I think most archaeologists today who are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, that movie kind of helped to inspire us. Now, obviously, we know, Indiana Jones is a problematic character, and that's not how archaeology is done, although we knew that punching Nazis would still be appropriate in 2019, but that's another conversation for another time. But Tanis has always fascinated me. It's an amazing, extraordinary archaeological site. It's one of the largest sites in Egypt. It's over a kilometer, I think it's a kilometer and a half in length, so almost it's massive. It almost looks like South America kind of tilted on its side. And, we know a lot about Tanis because of the work that was done there just prior to the outbreak of World War II by a French archaeologist, Egyptologist named Pierre Monte. And he and his team, they were excavating in the temples of Tanis. And I should say Tanis is Egypt's capital around 3,000 years ago. It lasted for hundreds of years as Egypt's capital. It was a massive, amazing site and incredibly rich. And Monte and his team found the more or less intact burials of multiple kings from the 20th, 21st dynasties. So this is towards the end of Egypt's new kingdom, moving into a time called the Third Intermediate Period. And these kings were known as the Silver Pharaohs. So unlike the gold sort of sarcophagi and coffins that we saw in the new kingdom, in this case, we had actual silver coffins. Which was really rare. So a massive, massive wealth. And unfortunately for Monte, they were discovered just before World War II, and so the world hardly knew about them. The bigger discovery than Tut, in my opinion. Mm. So it's a really important site. So, yes, the French team really hadn't done much work on the settlement of Tanis. So we used very high-resolution satellite imagery and helped to map out the city, which we're very excited about.
By mapping out the city, does that give future excavators a sort of a map of where they're likely to find the most artifacts, the most information that will give them information about the people that live there?
Yeah, so, it's really hard to think about excavating a city or a place if you don't have a good map. And the map that we've created is very clear. You can clearly see buildings and structures and streets and how they changed over time. Even without excavating, we have a pretty good sense of what the city, may have looked like and how it changed. And we can see administrative buildings, some areas that, potentially could be palaces, which is where the kings would have lived. So yeah, I mean, I don't personally excavate there, but you know, for future archaeologists, I can help to direct them exactly where to dig, which we need. You know, we can't just put random holes in the ground. We like to know exactly where to go.
So this is one of the things that's really interested me about using remote imagery is that, you know, even sites that have been, you know, you've been punching holes in the area for decades, you know, maybe multiple decades, you can still find unknown sites at some of these well-researched and excavated sites. I was reading a couple of things that you've found, like at a site at Petra, which I would think that archaeologists have been all over Petra. A Roman port, you found a Roman amphitheater where, you know, I guess guys had just been walking by. They didn't even know that that amphitheater was there.
Right. So, you know, in so many sites around the world, you know, archaeologists have been working at these sites for a very long time, and in some cases they're using different kinds of ground-based remote sensing technologies to map them. And for the site near Rome, my colleagues had done really amazing work there for decades, but there was one part of the site where they'd used one form of ground-based remote sensing, and because of the composition of the ground soil, it hadn't worked. And in archaeology, we say absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. You have to think about why things are showing up or aren't showing up. And so the satellite imagery showed, you know, it's a very clear outline, and lo and behold, you know, it could be this massive amphitheater structure. So, you know, we just have to use different things in different places and also be very cautious and careful. As much as I am an evangelist for the technology, I'm also a scientist and I think pretty pragmatic. And I feel like you've got to be really honest about when things work and when things don't work. And that's okay. This is science. You know, we test things and then we try to get better for next time.
So did they find an amphitheater there, or is it just evidence that probably there is an amphitheater based on the sort of shapes that you saw when you applied your algorithms to the images?
Yeah, so it's the same size and shape of an amphitheater. It's at a part of the site where it could, you know, it's a logical place for them to have placed one, but they need to go and excavate, and, you know, that's something I think they're planning on doing in future seasons, but it certainly looks very promising.
Yeah. What is an example of a site where you have found it from space and you've had I think it's two different things. You can identify a possible spot in space, but until you actually get down on the ground and excavate, and that takes a lot of money and time, you don't really know for sure. Can you tell us a story of one where you were able to find one and then actually discover?
You know, there are so many. I'll give you one, for example. So we happened in Tunisia where, you know, it looked, this Roman site, you know, things looked really promising. So it was in southern Tunisia years ago, collaborating with a team at Leicester University in the UK. And it was a very clear, what looked to be a Roman period fort. We went on the site and there was all this sort of blackness on the ground. And we couldn't really figure out what that was from the satellite imagery, but walking on the surface of the site, it became clear it looked like a dense, massive, big black blob covering a large part of the site. Turns out that the site was a pretty major center for pottery production. And you have this byproduct often when you're making pottery or you're making metal or iron ore called slag. And it's this melted, globby, semi-glassy material. And that was just covering the site. So that's something that we could see it from space, but we had no idea what it was. And when we got on the ground, we realized what it was, and it helped to show the importance of the site, because you're not going to have a major center of trade in that part of North Africa unless it's a big, you know, pottery production center.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Now, I know that you're using a remote imagery in different ways, which I would think that we would use it. I read something where it's being used in spotting likely spots for hominid fossil sites in Africa. I guess trying to find other Olduvai gorges or something like that?
Oh, so this is a project that I did in collaboration with Louise Leakey years ago with National Geographic. And we got type of imagery. This isn't satellite imagery. It's data that we collected on an airplane from something called a hyperspectral camera. So normal satellite imagery collects information in the near, middle, and far infrared parts of the light spectrum. But the swaths of data are very broad. So you get very large parts of the spectrum that are contained within each picture. And that's fine for doing general analyses. And so they're called bands of data. You know, maybe you'll get 7 or 15 bands of information. Well, what's amazing about the hyperspectral camera is that they collect data in hundreds of bands. So the ranges of the light spectrum are much more narrow. And it's the kind of data that things like gas or oil companies will use for prospecting, because they're looking for very narrow bands of spectra that may indicate where, you know, oil or mineral fields may be. And so we applied this technology in the Turkana Basin and tried to look at areas where there were fossil deposits. And our hypothesis was that, okay, if we can analyze these fine spots and figure out the signature, the chemical signature, the geological makeup of those areas, if we look for other areas like that, there could potentially be additional fossil sites. So we did the study, and you know, now we still have to do the ground confirmation. But there are definitely other areas there that have the same signature as fossil fine spots. And I think this is a technology that can be applied to, you know, to physical anthropology, to paleontology, to find more dinosaurs. You know, it's not a field that's been applied as much in paleontology.
My guest today is Sarah Parkak. She's an archaeologist, Egyptologist, and space archaeologist using a remote sensing to find ancient sites. She's a professor of archaeology at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and she'll be the next Tulsa Town Hall After Dark speaker coming up Thursday, April 11th. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the other uses you're using for remote sensing, which we alluded to earlier, is the hugely damaging specter of looting, which certainly in the last 20 years, you've been hearing so much news with all the destruction of ancient sites from, various fundamentalist groups like ISIL and others. But even after the invasion in Iraq and after times of intense economic upheaval in various parts of the Middle East, you've seen this huge surge in looting. How are you using remote sensing imagery to help understand how to protect from looting?
So, you know, looting has been going on for thousands and thousands of years. You know, the pyramids in Egypt were probably looted shortly after the kings were buried in them. Same with tombs in the Valley of the Kings. Even Tut's tomb, which everyone thought or thinks is intact, was looted probably by the burial party. I guess you can take it with you as long as you're still living. So this is just part of who we are as humans. So it's definitely not a modern trade at all. And looting is going on all over the world, you know, in Peru, in the U.S., in China, in India, Europe. You know, it's a global issue. And so typically, and I guess what's, you know, it's awful, but it's good for us, is that it's really easy to detect from satellite imagery. So say you have a tomb, and it doesn't matter where that tomb is. You know, it could be in the U.S., it could be in China, it could be in Egypt. The looters will dig down, and there'll be an sort of an oval donut shape of darker earth around a square as they're going down to dig out the tomb. And that looks the same everywhere in the world. Looting is looting. I've seen looting from many, many, many sites in different countries, and it all more or less looks the same. So with satellite imagery, depending on when it's taken, you can find the looting. It doesn't tell you that is the day that the looting happened, but you can get progression images, so a series of satellite images taken over weeks or months, and you can see the progression of the looting over time. And so you can see what sites are being looted, how much damage there is, how many looting pits there are, and you can give that information over to authorities. Because, you know, with the work I do, with the work my colleagues do, with the work my not-for-profit Global Explorer does, you know, we're not enforcement entities. It's never up to individuals who are not in countries where looting is happening to tell the governments what to do. You know, we're data providers, so we share the information with the governments, and then it's up to them with whatever rules are in place to act as enforcement agents.
I'm glad you mentioned Global Explorer. I did want to mention that at the end. This is an idea that you have about expanding the number of people looking at this data, citizen scientists. You're trying to map Peru, and you're using Global Explorer to help expose places where looting is growing.
Correct. So, yes, so Global Explorer is a citizen science crowdsourcing platform. It allows anyone to look at satellite imagery and help both map looting and find potential new sites. We designed it in a very intentional way to make it really user-friendly and fun. We've had now, we're up to 85,000 users from over 100 countries. So if anyone listening is based in North Korea, we don't have anyone from North Korea yet. We'd love to have you using the platform. And it was a real challenge, right? You know, can you create something for average, everyday people to engage them in exploration. For me, you know, one of my big goals is to make exploration of something that everyone can contribute to, no matter what your age or where you live. You know, I wanted to make something where people could use it at their local library or use it in their schools. And it was a bit risky because we didn't know if it would work and whether or not the crowd would actually find things that then archaeologists could use. And if you're worried about looting, I should say that when you go on the platform, which we started in Peru, and you look at the imagery, there's no maps and there's no GPS information. So all you know is that you're somewhere in Peru. The only people that get the coordinate information are my team and then professional archaeologists in Peru. And that's the way we'll do it moving forward. We really want to protect site integrity more than anything else. And our crowd found over 29,000 what we're calling anthropogenic features. So, you know, potential sites and features. And over 700 of them are actually major archaeological sites. And we collaborated with a team in Peru that does drone mapping, led by a good friend of mine, Dr. Luis Jaime Castillos, who is the former vice minister of culture in Peru. And he took Global Explorer data that the crowd had helped to generate and took it to the Nazca region in southern Peru. And he and his team used drones and found 50 new Nazca lines while mapping or helping to map some of the features that we found. So this is one of our goals, you know, that get the world engaged, get them helping to make real contributions, and then sharing that data with the in-country experts, because they're always going to be the ones that know what to do best with the data our crowd generates. And next, we're going to India. We've just announced our second country. We're really excited. Obviously, India is a massive place with amazing history and culture, so we're really, really excited about that. We're rebuilding the platform, and we're going to relaunch it towards the end of this year.
All right. Well, it sounds like it's an incredible project, and it sounds like you've given the authorities in Peru, you know, places to look and excavate for decades.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think for us, it's a constant, we're constantly learning because this project work at this scale has never been done before. And so, you know, we're trying to do it in the most, you know, ethical way possible. And we're trying to do it in the way that more than anything else respects the authority and the guidance of the countries wherever we go. So we, as I said before, we see ourselves as really a technology resource. And whenever we go into a new country, we offer them a menu of what Global Explorer can do. And then we work directly with governments and NGOs and our in-country subject matter experts and partners. And they really let us know what their needs are. And we adapt Global Explorer to meet their needs. So in India, we're very excited, you know, first obviously about what's there, but that we can do so much more in terms of education and outreach. And you know, it's so many of the states haven't been properly mapped. So we're very excited about what we're going to find.
All right. Well, we look forward to hearing more when you speak at Tulsa Town Hall and Tulsa Town Hall After Dark. Sarah Parkak, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Space archaeologist and Egyptologist Sarah Parkak, a professor of archaeology at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and contributor to the National Geographic, and the person behind the Global Explorer online archaeology platform, will be the next Tulsa Town Hall After Dark speaker. That lecture takes place Thursday evening, April 11th at 7 o'clock. For ticket information, visit tulsatownhall.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.